the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there this special week. A lot of people taking the whole week off, which gives you more time to listen to great shows like this. Us entrepreneurs need to use vacation time to get a little bit ahead or get a little bit caught up in our area. And this is the beginning of the Christmas season, end of year, which is so important. A lot of us still need to get that final 10th, that final 15% of sales in to hit our targets. A lot of us need to figure out how to spend a little money to get our revenue down for the year, not our revenue, but our total profit down for the year so we don't get taxed as much. Anyway, I know you're going to spend a lot of time listening to these shows because we've got some important information. First up, we're going to talk with Adam Rosen about email outreach and how to use unsolicited email as a great marketing tool. And then from Australia, Brad Giles will be with us to talk about the idea that bigger isn't always better, which is something I have certainly experienced. We will talk about it in the show. It's a fascinating interview. Two great ones today. Oh, and tomorrow we will drop our Thanksgiving show, 50 Things to Be Thankful For During Thanksgiving. So we will drop that tomorrow. Make sure you listen. Have a good day. We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to welcome another great guest. Please welcome Adam Rosen to the show. He is the founder of Email Outreach Company, EOC. It is a multi-million dollar agency helping small businesses like us and big businesses to get out email and newsletters and to help grow using that strategy. He has had success doing this with Amazon, Apple, Goldman Sachs, Disney, hundreds of thousands of other users, and has had a lot of success doing this with real estate. And all of that led to his experience with EOC. Adam, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. So set the stage for us. What were you doing and what was going on before you started EOC?
Yeah, so I started my first company right out of college. So I did a 1-year MBA program, and 3 weeks before graduating, I decided to dive into entrepreneurship. And I had my first company for about 5 years before I sold that company in 2019. And anyone who has their own startup can probably attest to this, especially when it's your first startup. You make a million mistakes and you kind of learn as you go, because it's impossible to be fully prepared to start a business, whether it's your first or your 12th, but especially when it is your first. So we did a million things wrong in that first startup, but the one thing we always did exceptionally well was getting some of the biggest brands in the world as customers. You mentioned some of them earlier, and how we got just about all of our customers was from cold emailing them. So when I sold the company in 2019, I started to do a lot of work advising different startups. And one of those startups said to me, "Hey, Adam, my head of sales is struggling to get meetings on the books. Can you help?" And I had a conversation with her and I saw there was a big gap with what they were not doing when it comes to email. So long story short, I called my co-founder, my previous startup. I said, "Hey, I think we can help these guys out." That company ended up being our first customer, and now we've worked with about 170 customers, from early stage startups to companies like Allstate and the UFC, to power their emailing.
So are all of the assumptions the same as in cold or unsolicited mail, junk mail, that you hope to get 2% and something like that, and it's just a numbers game? Is it the same sort of assumptions?
Yeah, like any marketing, you know, email gets a bad reputation with some stuff like that. Like, it gets treated differently than running meta ads or heck, even a billboard in Times Square. But the reality is you have to put together the best possible message put it in a place where it's going to be reached and seen by as many folks within your ideal customer profile set. You have to communicate in an effective way, but at the end of the day, you got to get numbers. So with anything you do in marketing, email being no exception, you have to learn how to scale it effectively so that it can be seen by as many eyeballs as possible.
All right. What are some of the best practices that you do there? I have always found that if it looks like a friend sent it, as opposed to it looks like it got sent by MailChimp, that I'm more likely to open it and look at it. Is that true?
Yeah. Like when we get newsletters, which is typically what you would get through a MailChimp, we're used to either one, not reading it and just disregarding it, or two, reading it, but just consuming, but not taking an action on it. The best cold emails out there feel like, to your point, Jim, it was a one-to-one email sent by somebody who maybe you know or someone who you should know, where it feels very personal to who you are, to your business, and to a problem that you may be facing within your organization and how that solution may tie into solving that problem. But it has to feel one-to-one. It has to feel personal. If it feels like a mass blast that was lazily done, you're not going to get results.
And the mass blast look good. They have formatting and boxes and stuff, right? And email from my friend looks like he put it together in a half second.
Exactly. You should be able to consume the email in about 8 seconds and totally understand what it is, what they're trying to say, and how it can be useful. But it has to be plain text. Don't try to make it pretty. In fact, the prettier you make it, like putting images or links or, you know, boxes here or there, that's going to increase the likelihood you go into spam and your recipient's not even going to see it. So you got to keep it plain text. You got to keep it simple, and you got to make it easy for the recipient to understand what you're trying to communicate.
Yes, all very true. All right. So you started the business. Talk to us about that first year. How did it go? What were the problems you faced? What was it like to grow that first year?
Yeah, my co-founder and I, we were very intentional because of the, we're sales guys. We like to get new customers. So one of the biggest challenges in the first year was, how do we just focus on product? We had three beta customers that we worked with, and we just wanted to prove out, does this concept even have legs? So the first 9 months was just about working with those three customers, seeing, number one, do they want to renew with us month over month? They all did. Seeing, did they want to pay us more money month over month? Which all three of them did, because we were providing them added value. And then building out the product and the systems so that we can make hires to help do some of the nitty gritty work that we were doing. So we made a few hires, but it was really me and my co-founder just in the weeds, feeling out every groove of the process. So the first year was all about understanding, one, does this thing have legs? Number two, do our customers want to renew and expand? And three, can we build out systems so that we can scale it to more customers and more employees?
Right. What were some of the campaigns you were running in that year? Do you remember? Obviously, those three that you were referring to.
Yeah, all three were startups. So one of which was a solo founder that had no customers at all. She had just left Spotify and she was starting her new business. And she was basically having a coaching business. We got her gigs at NBC and Pinterest, among others, through our cold emailing. And the approach we took with her was what we call an advice style approach. So it wasn't a hard sell. It was more of, hey, I'm building this business. Would you be open to sharing your advice in 10 or 15 minutes? And then when those people would get on calls with her, they saw, hey, I like what she's offering. This is interesting. Why don't we bring you in and we could be one of your customers? So I think she landed about 30 or 40 customers in her first year and a half through working with us, and most of which were from that advice style campaign. Another one of our customers was selling into healthcare. They also didn't have any customers, and healthcare market is a challenging one. But we were selling into a lot of hospitals to get them sales meetings to sell their product. The other customer was a startup that was a little further along. They raised some capital, but they were selling a talent acquisition solution. So for them, we were getting them into some pretty big brands like AT&T and Kraft Heinz and others to sell their software. So all three were very different use cases, which was important to us because we wanted to see, is this something that can work? across industries, and that kind of gave us a good sense early on.
All right. And how many years have you been going now?
I've had email outreach company for about 4.5 years.
4.5 years. Okay. And so how would you measure it in terms of growth, in terms of scale? Employees, millions? How's it doing, Adam?
One of my biggest pet peeves I noticed during my first tech startup is how the ways people would judge success of your startup was, one, how much capital did you raise? And two, how many employees do you have? The reality of both of those is neither of which are an actual indicator on business health. So with my startup now, we are bootstrapped, which I love being bootstrapped. And we do have, we have 17 employees, but I would rather have less employees than more employees. So the way we measure success is growth in terms of revenue and, of course, profit.
Being a bootstrap company. I can't ask those, Adam. That's impolite for me to ask what's your revenue. But I can ask how many employees. I just want to get an idea of scale, right? We want to know if it's you in the closet or you and 17 other people on the floor of an office downtown. It makes a difference,
And so, exactly.
Yeah, but I can't say how many millions did you do last year. That's rude of me.
No, Jim, you can. It's okay.
How many millions did you do last year, Adam?
Oh, we can't tell you that, Jim. You know that. but the metric we always look at is we're doing well in that. We hit $2 million ARR recently. We're looking at getting to 2.5 before the end of this year, and then we're looking to double that for next year. So I gave you some good numbers there.
Yes, very helpful. Excellent. So sounds like you were doing a lot of small customers. Are you still doing small businesses like that, solo coaches and things, or have you grown out of that?
Yeah, I love helping entrepreneurs because that's always been my thing, but we don't have a ton of those early stage startups anymore. Most of our customers are in the 50 to 200 employee range. And then we do work with some very large companies like Allstate and, the UFC. But a lot of our customers are in that 50 to 200 employee range.
All right. So you wouldn't be even interested in a smaller customer now?
No, about 20 to 25% of our customers are still sub 10 employees.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What does a campaign cost? Is it based on the list and the size? Is it a fairly formulaic type thing?
Yeah, the way we try to keep things simple. So for us, it's less about like you're paying for one campaign, and it's more of like you're hiring an SDR or a BDR. So like we just charge a monthly retainer, kind of like what you would pay an employee. And then we run a certain number of campaigns for you each month that goes out to a certain number of recipients. And then we'll do things like omni-channel. So we'll do LinkedIn for some customers. We'll build out newsletters for some customers. We'll even do calling for some customers. So cold email is our foundation. That's where we get the bulk of our results. But we have some customers that we're doing a lot more things, or CRM integrations. So there's a lot in the email world that we can do. But at its core, we're doing a lot on the cold email side.
And what would a low cost engagement be?
Typically, our lowest paying customers are paying us around $3,000 a month. Although we do have consulting customers that pay us less, and that's more on like an hourly basis, depending on how many calls they want with us in a month.
Okay. I think that's very fair. Where do you get the list? I have quite an extensive as a consumer in the list buying space, and I have some amazing stories there that are all going in a book. I got forced by a board to hire a list guy back in the 90s. And, I learned where you get the list. You buy the list of people who subscribe to Forbes, and you cross that with the people who bought a house last year, and therefore you get people who want to buy boats this year, right? That kind of work. And I was interested to see how all of that worked. Is that still the same way you build a list nowadays? If I want a list of gun owners, you can, get a list of gun owners. Is that still all true?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different list sources you can buy from. The key is to make sure that they're reputable. Like a lot of people will sell really crappy data that's old, inaccurate. So you have to be really careful with the list sources you use. There's a lot of good publicly accessible lists that are pretty inexpensive. Like there's a lot of people that use Apollo data, for example. But there's a tool out there called Clay, which I highly recommend for anyone, not just in the email space, but anyone in the marketing space should be using this technology. It's a phenomenal enrichment tool. So when you talk about running campaigns to do deep personalization, you can enrich data no matter where you're getting the data from to, number one, figure out if the data is even accurate. But number two, getting signals on people to indicate if they're going to be a good fit for your audience. So like, for example, I have a big newsletter with a New York Times bestseller where it's all focused on Gen X men. So we'll enrich data through Clay, for example, to find people that are looking to go after the male demographic in a certain age, bracket. We can enrich data to know when people leave their job or accepting a new job, when they use this technology versus that technology. So because of some tools out there like Clay, you can do really powerful enrichment to allow you to get more target in your outreach.
What is that? Clay.com? No. What's the, how do you find Clay? What do you look for? Clay marketing app?
Yeah, just Clay.com.
Oh, okay. Clay.com. Really?
Yeah, Clay.com. It's one of the most well-funded tools right now in the email space. And really, it's just a powerhouse tool when it comes to data enrichment. So I am a big believer anyone who's in the marketing space needs to learn and master Clay.
All right. I hadn't heard of that yet. Obviously, I'm not in the marketing space. So Adam, what does a great result look like? If you send out 1,000 emails, are you ever getting 20%, or what would a great result look like?
If you say, and again, all this is on volume. Like if you are manually prospecting and you're sending 1,000 emails and you're spending 2 weeks to do that, yes, your results should be better. But if you're emailing at scale, if you can get one positive reply per 1,000 emails you send, you're doing a phenomenal job in the email world. And if you get there, assuming your universe of potential customers is large, which for most companies it is, then you can scale your efforts from there. But if you can get one positive, it's funny when people say that though to me, because if you ever run like a meta, you know, an ad on Facebook, for example, your impressions will be like, you know, 28,000, you'll get X amount of likes or comments, and then you'll have 17 people fill out your form. So it's all the same. It just, I feel like email is treated a little bit differently than all other marketing, because again, all that is an impression. Same with Facebook, or same with LinkedIn ad, or heck, same with a billboard in Times Square.
Do you do SMS as well? What's the difference in that market?
I stay away from SMS for a few reasons. One, legally, there's a lot more regulations around SMS versus email. Number two, I'm just not a big believer in SMS for B2B work. So I think if you're direct to consumer, SMS can work a lot better, but I'm not a big believer in B2B when it comes to SMS.
Yeah, that makes sense. Especially for B2B, that would be inappropriate. If you were to hit me up in the weekend, trying to get me to buy more dam filters, I don't think that I would like that.
Yeah, it's funny, even, you know, going back to that, like during my first startup, my business was a college recruiting startup. So basically we built a platform of about 100,000 student organizations at colleges. And then we would sell into, you know, Amazon, Apple, Goldman, Disney, you name it, that wanted to, one, recruit those students, but two, get data on those students to better understand what Gen Z wants in the future of work. So the reason why I bring that up is because one of the questions one of our big sponsors wanted us to ask in the survey was, how do you want our recruiters to communicate with you? Is it by phone? Is it emailing you? Or is it sending you a text message? Everybody assumed, okay, this is Gen Z. They're always on their phone. They're going to want text message. The overwhelming majority said they wanted to be communicated with via email. And the reason why is they said phone, text message, that's more personal. Email, they relay that more to business and school and professional. And I think the same goes for most people out there. I'm certainly not a Gen Zer, but for me, it's like, if you're on my phone, if you're texting me, I want to already have a relationship with you. I don't want people trying to sell me a software through text message, sell it to me through email or through LinkedIn. That's where I am when I want to look at my business and professional work.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. That makes sense to me. What about the time to response? SMS, you would assume the response is quicker. Email, it seems, well, it seems that even with text, people are more slow to respond than ever before. It used to be you were supposed to respond immediately. Now you send a text and people might not respond for 2 or 3 days, which is the same with email. You know, people usually don't respond to email within a day or so. That's very rare in good service if you do get that. Do you find this, what about the difference of response to different media? Have you learned anything there?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have enough data on the texting side just because we're not doing it.
Yeah, you're not that guy. I get it.
But on the email side, though, what is interesting is, to your point, there's times, Jim, where someone will get an email and they'll say, oh, you know what? I'll look at this tomorrow or the next day, and then they forget about it, which is why it's important to follow up effectively. But the majority of replies we actually get on a campaign come in the first 30 minutes of sending the campaign, of them receiving the email, I should say. And the reason why is if it is something that's top of mind and interesting, which in reality, if they're getting a cold email and they're interested in it, it's most likely top of mind or something they're interested in. They're going to respond quickly, because if they don't, they read it, they're most likely just going to forget about it and then never get back to you. So the majority of replies you get are actually quick. Of course, if they are interested in what you are offering.
Right. I mark them unread if I want to go back to them. And then about once every month, I delete the 50 things that I haven't read yet.
Exactly. I'm the same way. I keep them unread, but there's people, man, you'll look at their inbox and it's like 1700 unread emails, which I don't know how people can live like that. I'm the same way. I'll try to mark something as unread if it's interesting to me, and then I'll get back to you to it when I have the time to get to it. But a lot of people, if it is interesting and they really want to meet, they will get back to it shortly after receiving the campaign.
Sure. Yeah. So where's the business now? You're about four and a half years in, 17 employees, several million in accounts and income. What are your goals with it, Adam? Is it big enough? You going to cap it where it is and just have a nice life? Or is the goal to get it to 50 million in revenue? What do you want to do with this?
For me, I get very bored if I'm not growing with anything, whether it's building a business or if I'm training for a race or whatever it might be. If I'm not growing, it's very boring. So I'm always looking to grow. That's number one. And it sounds very basic, but it adds up quickly. So for me, it's just, can we double every year? If we double every year, before you know it, you're going to be at some really exciting numbers, like you said, 50 million. So I try not to think
that way.
Exactly. Next thing you know, we'll be a multi-trillion dollar company if we keep it that doubling path. So no, for me, it's just, I try to keep things simple. There's a million things you could focus on when you're building a startup. So I just try to keep things simple. It's one, can we get new customers? Two, can we keep those customers and hopefully expand those customers because of the value we are providing? And three, can we be profitable? And those are just three simple metrics that we're always looking at. But yeah, for me, it's, can we increase our enterprise value? Can we double each year? If we could do that, then only good things are going to come from it.
How do you market right now?
Half of our customers come from doing what we do, which is cold emailing.
Okay.
So the biggest chunk of our customers come from cold emailing. We do get quite a few customers from podcasts that I go on. We do get quite a few customers from referrals. But yeah, the bulk of our customers come from us just doing cold email campaigns like we would do with our customers.
I like that. You're using your own sauce.
We got to do it. If you ever talk to a marketing company and they tell you they don't get any customers from the type of marketing they do, that's probably not the best sign.
What are you most excited about for the Thanksgiving holiday and the long weekend? What's the biggest excitement? The food, the football, the leaves?
Well, I'm a Jets fan, so I'm a Jets fan. So football wise, there's nothing to really be excited about ever. So that's not as much the football, but I'm excited to spend time with family. So I'll be able to see a lot of my family for Thanksgiving. So I'm excited for that. Of course, the good food. But yeah, unfortunately, I wish my football team was a little bit better, but we will be maybe in the next 60 or 70 years.
I heard you might get Bill Belichick as your coach.
Well, I'll put this on the record. Maybe it's because I'm like the jealous ex-boyfriend of it. He spurned us about 25, 30 years ago. So I would have no interest in Bill Belichick coming back to the Jets.
No, I think he's lost his mojo at this point.
So. Yeah, I tend to agree. And if we're going to lose, I'd rather lose with our own guy, Aaron Glenn, than somebody who already said he didn't want us 25 years ago.
So Adam, let me tell one more story first. So this guy back in the 90s that my board forced me to hire for outbound on, you know, cold email or letters and envelopes and mail. We had a meeting where we did all of the planning and we wanted to get out of the office. And so we actually went to my parents' house. They had a big dining room that we could get and had service and people to take care of us and everything. And after the end, the guy sent my mother a huge bouquet of flowers. My mother was all impressed. And then we got the bill at the end of the month. He had billed me for the flowers plus a 20% handling charge for the flowers sent to my mother from him. And I was like, that says a lot. I was blown away by the chutzpah of that. That one of the early shocks in my career that people would pay for flowers with your money and then charge you for it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a heck of a good deed to do. It's the worst thing about that too, is if they just didn't do it, period, they would have been in a better position versus doing something that you assumed was a good deed and then turned out to be not just a trade-off of, yeah, you're going to pay us for the flowers, but they also are profiting off of the flowers they bought your mother. So yeah, the chutzpah to do that is pretty interesting. And one of my mentors always said, he said, Adam, it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and just a moment to lose it. And I feel like that is a great example of losing your reputation very quickly off of that one bill.
I still talk about it 30 years later. How do we find out more? Follow you online, all of that.
On social, I am most active on Instagram or LinkedIn. That's at Adam I. Rosen, R-O-S-E-N. My website is eocworks.com.
Fantastic. We'd love to have you back in a year or so and get an update on the story. Thanks a lot for sharing this, and happy holidays.
Thanks, Jim. Happy holidays. Happy Thanksgiving. We'll talk soon.
And we will be right back. We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Brad Giles to the show. He is a multiple five-time author and very successful coach and consultant. He is the owner of, I forgot the name of the company. Scroll down. Leaders, damn it. Evolution Partners. There we go. And the new book is called Bigger Isn't Better. Better is better. Avoiding the pressure for endless growth to build a better business. Brad, welcome. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Jim. I am absolutely on top of the world.
He is also an author and has a show called Evolution Partners Podcast and has been very successful. He went to MIT for a master's program. Very successful. Cool career, Brad. Tell us about it.
I would say that I've just always had a crack. I've always, in different domains, different areas, I've always been interested in entrepreneurship. I was the kind of kid that was getting in trouble in school for, you know, doing a little bit of entrepreneurship on the side, all very legal, of course. But I have started six companies over my career, and been doing leadership team coaching and strategic planning probably for 15 years. And I gained great joy from it, Jim. It just It offers competitiveness. It offers the ability to challenge yourself. I love it.
Well, fantastic. You're in the right place then. Let me ask you a stupid question. Obviously, tomorrow is Thanksgiving here in the United States. Obviously, you don't celebrate Thanksgiving, yes, or it's a different holiday for you, different part of the year. How different is entrepreneurship there? Is it obviously the same rules apply, marketing and finance, and you have to be cash flow positive. What is it culturally like there in Australia? Is it super cool like in California? Are people shy about it like in Japan? What is the overall Australian perception of entrepreneurship?
So we have a similar tax code that encourages entrepreneurship. So if you were an employee, you would pay a higher, I guess, tax rate compared to a company. So structurally, there is an encouragement. Beyond that, though, it's perhaps across the general population, it's okay to have your own small business, but there's a cultural challenge within Australia that's called tall poppy syndrome. And what that means...
Oh, I've heard of that. Too much cheap.
Yeah. So if you pop your head up amongst a crowd is the general concept, people will cut you down. And it's not a very nice thing, but it is certainly a part of the Australian laid back, she'll be right, mate, kind of cultural aspect. But you know, like it's just another barrier. Government is a barrier, for us, like yourselves in its own way. The market, the competition, we just got to go out and build great companies.
Love the attitude. How hard is it in Australia? You know, in America, we can get a business license in 10 minutes and then you're pretty much legally up and running. Obviously we have some really stupid laws that are designed to protect industry. You know, we have laws like you can only put ice cream in a container with $1 million machine. You can't do it by hand. Why is that law there? To protect the small, to protect the big guys, right? That's literally a law here in Georgia. So we have silly things like that designed to help big business. Do you have the same problems? Do your governmental candidates ever talk about small business?
Well, put it this way, the federal, I don't love politics, right? There are people playing their own power games and I focus on business, but the federal small business minister has never run a business, has a professor, is a doctorate in Middle Eastern politics, and I don't even know if they ever visit small businesses at all. So it's really, you know, it's very easy to get a business, like you said. It only takes a few minutes to get a business license or the ability to operate, but you really got to do it yourself, and there are lots of things working against you.
Yes. Very true. All right. So Evolution Partners, 16 years old. Who are your most normal clients? How big and in businesses?
So we only do one thing and we endeavor to do it really well. And that one thing is leadership team facilitation. Smallest is maybe 2 million in revenues. The Australian dollar is, let's just say roughly on par. It's not at 60 cents to the American dollar, but just think of it in similar terms. So about 2 million revenue all the way up to 200 million. And it's a very wide range. But the one thing that we do is we get leadership teams offsite and help them to build a strategic plan to give them the best possible chance to succeed.
What are teams normally struggling with? What are the issues that you have to deal with?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jim. I probably built 1,000 plans in my career and coached CEOs along that way around that, if that makes sense. So I would say that 70% of the time, it's people issues, meaning I can't find someone. This person isn't doing their job. This person is culturally toxic. A whole range of things in that domain. But a company is just people doing stuff, right? So it's somewhat logical that you would have most of the problems being people problems then. But to your question, yeah, mostly people problems.
And is that I don't like you or organizational issues? Not clear. What is a people problem?
I am constantly surprised at the many, many different ways that people problems can arise. You imagine how dumb the average person is, right? Half the population are dumber than that. No, I mean people across the board, right? Half the people are dumber than that, right? So people will do things that are against their own best interests. You speak about Australian legislation. One of the big challenges that we've got here is for employers is unfair dismissal. And it's very, very, very hard to fire someone. And it's very, very easy for them to come up with spurious claims, basically to get a payout in the tens of thousands of dollars. So it's just hard. But people problems, and that's not connected to the people problems, but we need to hire someone because we've got growth and we can't find someone. The second book that I wrote was about onboarding. And onboarding is like the smallest, ugliest little runt puppy dog that, as a metaphor for a process that no one ever, ever looks at, right? And everyone lets go. But a lot of people problems come from we hire people, but we don't onboard them well. I think that lots of people problems from people not doing their job. People who I guess are insubordinate or people who are, all sorts of things, but just the majority is people problems to your question.
All right. I want to go back in time in the 1990s, Brad. I built a summer camp business and cool. It was very expensive to start a new location, a new city, $20,000-$30,000. But in year two or three in a city, it would produce $100,000 in revenue. And we grew, we started at two locations, Stanford and MIT. And then we added the second year, we went to six, added UCLA, SMU, Emory, and someplace else. And then we went to 14 locations. And at that point we met and big time American famous guy who I'm sure you know of, you've heard of this guy. And he said that we had a chance to take over the entire children industry and to be the head of children and we should grow as fast as possible. And so we went to from 26 locations to 89 locations in year six.
Yep.
And oh my God, I still hurt from that summer. That year was such a disaster for us. And I have spent 1,000 hours, and I'm not teasing, Brad. You know, wow. It's been 30 years, a couple of hours a day and a couple of hours driving here and, you know, a long walk here. And I spent hours, thousands of hours, just wondering what would have happened if we had stopped at 26? We had just stopped at 26. And rode it on out into the sunset. You know, it had those businesses that hadn't grown much in 20, 30 years, but it was making $10 million a year with zero thought, effort, work, new initiative.
Yeah.
There's my little story. Talk to me, Brad, about your thesis.
So it's a very interesting story and a very common story. So the title of the book is Bigger Isn't Better, Better is Better. But what it's not is bigger isn't better, smaller is better. So I am absolutely and completely for ambition have a crack, get out there, give life your best shot. Because I reckon the regret of the dying that people don't talk about is not actually having a real go at life. People regret that. I think that we've heard of people saying, well, you know, I wish I hadn't spent as much time in the office. I wish I'd spent as much. But I reckon that there's another regret, which is I didn't have it. So I absolutely believe in we've got to have a good crack at life. But that means not getting your business now and making it smaller. It means making it better. So to your situation, I mean, I've seen this over, maybe not over again, but I've seen a lot of people who are spruiking. Look, here's what you can do. Give me $500 and I'll make your business 10 times bigger, or I will make your business so much more remarkable. But what they don't ask at the beginning, is that what you really want? Is that going to give you a better life? So we have this pressure in the world, and it's multifactored. It's a pressure from our psychology, the way that we're brought up, from our DNA, and from the world around us, and all of these things kind of create this recipe of ambition and this recipe of wanting to go for things that are so much bigger. And so when we and that's great, right? And everything in human achievement, everything that we've achieved as a human race has kind of in some way or another been connected to that. So I want that. Also, I want people to have lives that are better and businesses that are better, that serve their purpose. There is, you know, entrepreneurship, it just doesn't do what it says on the tin. And there are so many people who've had so much suffering because they can't avoid the pressure for the endless pursuit of more. So I think that rather than saying, should I have stopped there when I was at that point of the certain number of schools, I would offer the insight, well, am I at the point where I want? What do I want more? And how can I build a better team, better customers, better offering, and better financials so that I can build a better life by design?
So let me tell you another story. For awesome. About a decade, I was one of the judges for the Atlanta Business Person of the Year. And there was always the same eight of us that were the judges for about 10 years. And we loved it. It was a lot of fun, you know, locked in a conference room with people bringing you food, people coming in and telling you about their businesses. And we got to know each other pretty well. And we started, as groups do, sort of trading, you know, I'll give you this guy if you give me this girl and that kind of thing, you know, swapping off. And we had one guy come in who with an amazing business, web design, and he was doing $5 million and he had a huge house and a lot of cars. And he came in multiple years to try to win, and he never won. And finally, we realized he's the same as last year. He's $5 million again, $5 million again, $5 million again. And he never won because there was enough sentiment in the group that he should be $10 million. I mean, he should be 20 by now, but he was five, and his quality of life was probably higher, because we judged him for not growing, for not pushing harder. What are your thoughts?
I don't want to suppress anyone's ambition. I'm absolutely and completely committed to ambition, and this is what makes the world turn. I would probably be in the same camp as the judges. I mean, when I was younger, my business, one of my business, I've got all of the pieces of plastic that represent growth. I just think that, I mean, one of the awards that we won was the fastest growing company in, or the sixth fastest growing company in the country. So all the pieces of plastic are fine, and it doesn't amount to necessarily a better business or a better life. I think that your example is a good example where the person could have perhaps built a better business if they wanted to, and they probably had the business that they wanted to. I think that if, for example, you had a $3 million business and you put another zero on the end as your goal, you said, we want to go from 3 million to 30 million and I'm going to sacrifice everything along the way. I just don't know that is going to give you what you really want, because many people end up getting there and saying, well, my kids don't talk to me. My relationship with my family isn't what it is. I'm not in the greatest health that I could be. So it's about, I guess, understanding that the growth for growth's sake, getting stuck in the loop of the endless pursuit of more might not actually be what you want, and that you can build a better business with a team and customers and offerings and financials that really is what you want out of life.
Yes, all of those family issues and everything, you want to make money so you can give them a good life, but then you don't spend any time with them. So it is crazy what people do.
It is. So the seventh chapter is entitled A Better Life by Design. Inversely, how do you design a better life? And it's broken down into healthy, wealthy, wise, happy, and great family. So you can be healthy and you can be wealthy and maybe even wise, but if you're not happy or you don't have a great relationship with your family, and it makes me think about Thanksgiving. It's very much a family affair. In the way that you define family, if you don't have that relationship, what's it all for? It's not really for, you know, I mean, so many people, it's good to ask yourself the question, what's the lie that I'm telling myself? And the lie that many people might be telling themselves is, I'm doing this for my family, but the family is who's sacrificing. Again, so it's not about avoiding growth. The book is a mindset of compounding. It is, how do I compound a better business and a better life? But what it is about is finding your recipe, finding the thing that works best in your world so that you can design the life that you want.
Brad, how do I start making those mental changes? How do I start not caring about growth as much and putting that aside? And then how do I tell that to others? And, you know, are we going to lose employees because they don't have an opportunity to grow now? How do I deal with all of the various mindsets?
Yes, yes. There's a few questions in there. I'm going to miss one for sure. Like, I'll keep it a crack
at one time. So you're lucky it's only two or three in that one.
So how do I start? Well, I think, you know, the easiest way to learn is from other people's mistakes, right? The hardest way to learn is from your own mistakes. And I guess that this book is written from the blood and sweat and tears, metaphorically, of everyone I've known and worked with and my own journey. So it's a very personal book. So learning and understanding and then thinking, what is the lie that I'm telling myself? Being able to perhaps self-reflect is probably where I'd offer people to start. You know, any author is going to say, well, read the book, but I'm trying to, you know, help the audience in a very simple and direct manner. So I think just starting, like, you know, what is a better business look like? Does it actually look like that? Is it my ego that's telling me that I need to get to 30 million or whatever number it is and everything comes second? The second question you put in there was, if we're not growing, then should we be able to still attract employees employees?
Our employees can't become manager because the managers, we don't need new managers. You know, if you're not going to grow,
there's no career path.
It's a fair question.
It's a fair question for sure. I would say that this, so a business that compounds is a business that grows, but it's like net profit, right? If you focus all of your energy on net profit, it doesn't necessarily occur. It's a net consequence. So growth is a net consequence of a better business. Why? Because you've got a team. The first section is about building a better team, a team with soul, a team of A players that can be more effective. The inverse of that, to kind of double down on what you've said, when we've got a bigger mindset, right, what we do is we think all we've got to do is grow. So we'll hire anyone that we can, right? We're not going to focus on more time and more care on hiring. We'll just hire the people that we get. And this consequentially, you get B and C players to fill roles quickly. Then what happens is that you form dysfunctional and unproductive teams. And then those teams are less efficient and less effective, so we get poor results. And so then if we still have the bigger mindset, we have one answer, is that we've got to throw more people at the problem. So this creates what I call the bigger team doom loop. We just get more and more and more people who are mediocre, who aren't effective, and who aren't efficient. Now, inversely, when I say compounding, I'm talking about flywheels, right? So what do we do instead? We take the time to, with a good hiring process, to hire A players who are infused with passion, right? People who got soul. So we build these high productive teams with soul as a result of we've just got great people. They are more effective, they are more efficient, we get much better results, we enhance our reputation as a great place to work, to your question. And so that means that we're attracting more A players so we can hire more A players. So what happens when you get more of those people doing more effective and impactful work? Well, when you combine that with all of the other things, a business will absolutely definitely grow. One of the customers that we work with here in Australia, they've been using this mindset, this approach. They've grown at 300% over the last year. Now, what I'm saying is that this book is not called Bigger Isn't Better, Smaller Is Better. What it's saying is focus on the business, be a good custodian of your team, your customers, your offering, your financials, so that you can build a better life by design. So I think that in a awesome business, in a better business, there are great opportunities that are created.
Fantastic, Brad. I love it. Great attitude. It's more is better, but more happiness is, you've got to define what you want more of. And maybe that's just time at home, so, or whatever. Brad, I love the concept, and thank you for being here and talking about it. How do we find out more, get in touch, follow online, get a copy of the books?
So the book, again, is Bigger Isn't Better. Better is Better, Avoiding the Pressure for Endless Growth to Build a Better Business and Life. As you mentioned earlier, I've got a podcast, which is The Evolution Partners, and probably online. I'm on LinkedIn like everybody, Brad Giles, but mostly it's evolutionpartners.com.au is where you'll find me, and we do a weekly newsletter as well. Now, the only other thing I'd mention, also on that website, if listeners would like, there's a free first chapter just to dig into it and get a bit of a taste for it, available on the website.
I appreciate that so much. Brad, thank you so much for being with us, getting up early, and we'd love to have you back. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jim. Have a great day.
We are out of time, but have a great day, everyone. Take care. Bye now. Oh, make $1 million.